This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. One month ago, in early July, the nation saw a terrible week of turmoil, violence, and protest focused on longstanding complaints that African Americans are unfairly targeted by police. In the space of less than 7 days, two black men were killed at the hands of law enforcement, and then five police officers in Dallas were murdered by a sniper. The Monday after all this, The Exchange convened a panel of law enforcement and minority activists to hear from people directly involved in police-community relations. They vented their frustrations and fears and expressed their continuing hopes about efforts to build a better future. They also all said that New Hampshire needs to talk a lot more about this instead of pretending that these issues only happen somewhere else. And so today in The Exchange, we return to that conversation. What's unfolded since that shocking week, including the killing of three more officers in Baton Rouge, Louisiana? Let's hear from you this hour. Your thoughts, questions, comments, concerns are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Dottie Morris, Chief Officer for Diversity and Multiculturalism at Keene State College. And Dottie, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Lieutenant Patrick Cheatham. He's a patrol lieutenant in his 14th year with the Londonderry Police Department, also first vice president of the New Hampshire Police Association. And Lieutenant Cheatham, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Also with us, Chief David Mara. He's Portsmouth Police Chief. He's former Chief of Police in Manchester, where he spent 29 years on the force. And Chief Mara, welcome back to you, too. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
And joining us now is Willard Lett, battling a little traffic, but right here on time. Willard Lett, President of the Manchester NAACP. And Willard, it's always good to see you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, and Chief Mara, I want to start with you, but hear from everybody. So here we were a month ago. What kind of conversations have you had since these events?
I've had a lot of conversations. I've had conversations within the law enforcement field, as well as a lot of conversations with citizens. What we need to do, and I think it's happening, after that, what the tragic events that you just described, I think the community as a whole is discussing things a lot more. People are talking a lot more. What I felt necessary to do was reach out, have the Portsmouth Police Department reach out. Now, as you said, I'm new in Portsmouth, so what I did is I had my old friend, Willard Lett. He's not that old, but
I'm that old.
For radio viewers, he's not that old. But I had listeners. I asked him to introduce me to the Portsmouth NAACP president, and we went out for breakfast. We talked about issues, and then I was invited to an event that happened last night in Portsmouth, and it was put on by the Portsmouth NAACP.
So just last night?
Just last night, and Willard was joined us as well. He was there, and what it was not really a set forum with a moderator, so to speak. People just got to speak. There were there were several chiefs of police there, and there were several members of the community. There were several minority members of the community. There were people there that had grievances. So everybody got a chance to talk. But we found that the two-hour allotted time wasn't enough, and so we're going to be doing it again. And I hope we do it again in Portsmouth. So the Dover chief... I thought did a great job there as well as the NAACP.
So ongoing conversations, including this forum just last night. Just can you give us a flavor of some of the stuff that was said, Chief Mara?
There were some people there talking about how their rights were violated during their contact with police. There was a woman there talking about how she has two multiracial children, and she feels the town that she's living in It wasn't a complaint about the police, but she feels like that they are discriminated against. And there's some issues where how people and I like to go to these things and learn. It's not just a talk. And then you get a different point of view. You hear from, for instance, it was this one woman that she spoke afterwards. She actually was telling me. I thought it was a great story. Her family, she comes from a family of law enforcement. She has brothers that, and I apologize, I don't remember her name, but she is a member of the NAACP. But she has brothers in law enforcement. Her father, I believe, was in law enforcement. But she says that her husband still tells their kids, they are now older, but they're two boys, that if you get stopped by the police, you put your hands up and you put your hands up on the dashboard, and you have your license ready. Now, coming from a police officer's saying that, it really is, you know, it's a learning experience because we don't look at it that way. So we have to be able to see a different point of view. And her name was Sandy Clark. She is and this is something that really was something she. Then said that one of her kids got stopped in Bedford for speeding. She said her kid was speeding, and that when the officer approached, he did what he was told to do, and he was really nervous about being stopped by a police officer. And then when the officer came back during the conversation with the officer, the kid he had a bad cold, and when the officer came back, instead of giving him a ticket, he gave him a pack of Halls for his cold. And said, "Take care of that cold." So they're good contacts. It's not all bad contacts, but I thought that was a very good story.
Willard, again, we talked last month, and it was so great because all of you said, "You know, let's come back in a month, and maybe not even in crisis mode, and have this conversation again." What sorts of conversations have you had with people since we gathered a month ago?
Well, of course, this has been police and community relations has been a hot topic. And one of the things that people have commented most on with me is the fact that there was the recent shooting, police shootings in Louisiana and in Dallas, Texas, and what that means for this the situation of in some communities between police and those communities. It's like I think a lot of people feel like it's a bad situation that's gotten worse, you know. And people are concerned, you know. In some communities, people have always been concerned, but now there is a having had a historical sense of of challenge with the police and having a historical sense that in some communities, particularly communities of African descent, communities of color, that the police are not your friend and that the police are, that they're bad guys among the police just like they are good guys. With the police shootings, some people are concerned that is sort of giving license to what was already bad behavior in many instances.
It's going to make it worse. In other words, police will feel nervous because of these targeted killings of officers. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that some people feel like the police will feel justified in treating people the way, you know, that they've always treated them. But now the issue was, people are being treated unfairly. Well, now with the police shootings, it's like, oh, well, you know, it's justified in treating folk that way. I guess an example was it in Florida where the young guy was laying on the ground, a therapist working with the autistic client. He was laying on the ground with his hands in the air and ended up being shot by the police, you know.
How much more submissive do you need to look?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, you know. And so I think, though, that both the previous conversation and the conversation now is really missing the point. You know, I mean, we got to get to root causes in order to really make changes. But one of the things that is happening is there are conversations. There are increasing conversations. In addition to my friend in the Seacoast, Fred Ross, who helped set up the meeting last night in Portsmouth, there are also a couple of other initiatives that I know that are going on around the community where there is a ongoing and honest effort to engage community members and representatives of police forces in some discussion, hopefully, I guess with the intention, hopefully, of increasing understanding.
Lieutenant Chief, I'm going to turn to you next and then go to you, Dottie. Again, you were here a month ago. What's changed for you over the past month since that terrible week?
Well, as a police department, speaking specifically for Londonderry, especially having the opportunity to meet Mr. Lett last time and speak with Pastor Bertha over the telephone, we've asked ourselves, what can we do better? What are we doing wrong, if anything? And reaching out to the community, because that is important, as Willard said, and I think Dottie will probably agree, is that communication is the key. And if anyone feels that they're being persecuted, whether it's actually happening or not, is irrelevant, because if they feel that way, then that's not acceptable either. And it's important that we as police officers listen to people's concerns, listen to people's issues, and work through them, because we're public servants. We're here for the people. That's really we're in public service and community service. That's our mission. That's our job. I believe it personally and professionally, and that's why I've chosen to be a police officer, and I've been one for the last 14 years, and hopefully another 14 more. We'll see how many years I do in police work. But just continue to talk about the issues and trying to remain informed and current is important, and that can be overwhelming sometimes. But with social media and to our listeners, I'm holding up my cell phone here. I mean, between Facebook and unitleader.com and WMUR.com and NHPR, anyone can really any morning just skim through the headlines to see what happened overnight and what's going on in the area.
Since we last talked, you told me that you went to Dallas to attend the funerals of those police officers.
I did. It was an honor and a privilege. I traveled with three of my good friends from the Manchester Police Department. We flew Southwest, and I'd like to mention them because they were very generous, and they were the reason why we were able to fly down. They actually gave us free airfare to fly down to Dallas.
Really?
They're based out of Love Airfield in Dallas, Texas, but for the Southwest Airlines crew out of Manchester and also nationally down in Dallas. I just wanted to say thank you for them because we wouldn't have been able to afford to make that trip. But since that time, we were able to attend the funeral of Sergeant Michael Smith, who I believe was the fifth officer shot and killed that night. And it's hard to describe how it felt to be down there. There was a sense of calm around the crime scene. We went down there and talk about a small world. A good friend of mine from Bedford, New Hampshire, with whom I grew up and attended Trinity High School with, is actually a police officer in Richardson, Texas, which is about 5 minutes north of Dallas. And he was on security detail because so many of the surrounding law enforcement agencies came into Dallas to assist because the city, from my perspective, was still in shock and awe 1 week after these five murders. And he took us down to the crime scene, and it was just a sense of calm surrounding it. You could still see the bullet holes in the building. You could still see glass in the street from the explosions that hadn't been cleaned up yet. Of course, it was still an active crime scene, and the FBI was still there processing everything going on. So it's hard to describe what it felt to be down there other than, you see these things in the headlines, you see these things on television, and to actually be there such a short period after. And unfortunately, in my 14 years of police work, I've attended many funerals for line-of-duty deaths, and this one was one that will definitely stick with me for the rest of my life.
Well, and there have been more line-of-duty deaths this year. I wonder what you think, Lieutenant Cheatham, about Willard's concern that police being targeted will make police more nervous and more on edge, and then it just worsens attitudes. It just makes things worse.
I do think
it's hard to break through if you.
Well, it does give us concern. If you may remember, 2 or 3 years ago, there were two Pennsylvania state troopers who were ambushed and shot and killed for no reason. And I think they were in the back parking lot of their barracks. We had some police officers down, and I believe in the Carolinas, while pumping gas. Were shot and killed for no reason. They were targeted by a deranged individual. So even going further back than just the past 6 months of the past year, when those things happen, you can't plan for those things. You can prepare. You always have to be vigilant, but you can't. You know, you can't be walking on eggshells every time you go to work either. You know, you wouldn't be effective as a police officer if you were, you know, maybe in Chief Mark comment on what it, but I think he understands what I'm saying. So, I mean, you always have to be vigilant, but you can't go to work scared. You have to just know that, you know, based on you're going to rely on your training, you're going to rely on your experience, you're going to rely on your brother and sister officers, and you're going to rely on the community to support you as well and to help you.
Well, we'll definitely talk about training. And Chief Merrick, I can see you want to jump in, but I want to bring Dottie in just for a minute, too. And Dottie, it's, again, terrible week a month ago. A lot of people, no matter where they stand, kind of saying, wow, you know, what is happening in America? What sorts of conversations have you had with folks since all this broke out?
A variety of them. I was in Texas. I was in Houston at the time that the shooting occurred in Dallas.
Oh.
So I was around family, and we had a lot of conversations. My brother-in-law is a retired police officer in Houston, Texas. So it did add a lot of understanding of kind of the perspective that maybe a police officer would have in those moments. But a lot of concerns that were expressed when we were sitting around as a family talking about it, we don't want this to be another missed opportunity, because I think that we missed several critical opportunities where we could have had some intervention nationally before the events that we are currently talking about. So when we talk about the interaction that Henry Gates had with the police officers back several years ago, we missed that opportunity to have a real serious talk about race in the United States, policing, assumptions that people have of one another.
And just backtrack to that. I know what you're talking about, but just remind people real quick the Henry Gates story.
Henry Gates is a law professor, I think, at Harvard. And when he was entering his own home, a neighbor called and said that there was someone breaking into the home. Police officers appeared he was in Cambridge, right? Thank you. The police officer appeared on the scene. If you know Henry Gates, he's not a, you know, like this. He's probably about my age and Willard's age. So he's not, you know, he wasn't combative. And for some reason or another, things became pretty tense.
Well, he was upset. Here he is, this esteemed academic
right.
at Harvard, and he's just trying to get into his own house and being accused of breaking and entering.
Right.
So he was understandably upset.
Right. So I think that we missed a critical opportunity.
That led to the beer summit that Obama
had, right?
That's right,
the beer summit. And that, you know, we know how alcohol and never mind, I'll change the subject. but this whole idea that we missed that opportunity, I think we missed a critical opportunity with the Trayvon Martin situation. And I think that because we're not having these deeper level conversations, we keep coming back to the same place. And each time we come to this place, it's at a place that seems a lot more despondent or a lot more difficult, excuse me. So those are the kind of conversations we have, is like, how do we come up with the right questions to have those conversations? How do we come up with the questions that really will take us to a deeper level of connection with one another? And so in thinking about that, some of the questions I don't think that we fully addressed is, you know, what is it about this culture that leads to such violent behavior? And I don't care who we're talking about, but we have a culture that's deeply rooted in violence. And then if you add it with fear of dying, you have a really explosive situation. And I think that's what we're living with right now.
Okay, a lot more, obviously, to follow up in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We're still taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're revisiting our conversation about police and minority relations and efforts to get people together after the turmoil we saw in this country in July. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests with us in studio. Lieutenant Patrick Cheatham. He's a patrol lieutenant in his 14th year with the Londonderry Police. He's also first vice president of the New Hampshire Police Association. Willard Lett is also here, president of the Manchester NAACP. Dottie Morris is with us, chief officer for diversity and multiculturalism at Keene State College. And David Mara, Portsmouth's police chief and also former chief of police in Manchester, where he spent 29 years on the force. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. And Chief Mara, I did want to ask you about the point that several people have made, that when police are targeted, ambushed, like they were in Dallas, like they were in Baton Rouge, how does that change policing? And how does that affect efforts to make this better?
Well, as far as any kind of fear that any police officer would use that as justification to cause harm to somebody, I don't believe that would happen. If that would happen, that would be a criminal act. I don't see that happening. I see the opposite and I worry about it. What is going to happen if a police officer right now? A police officer has to make a split-second decision on a lot of things, and that decision is scrutinized by everybody. So we have to give that officer training. We have to continue training in that officer, and we have to evaluate him or her. But what I worry about is what will happen if a police officer now has in the back of the head, instead of making that split-second decision, they're now saying, am I going to be in the media? What is going to happen here?
Bystander video, body cam video. That's a new factor.
And that is why I think training and evaluating our police officers is so crucial to make sure that they are making the right decisions, to make sure that we've given them enough training to be able to do that. So that I actually worry about the opposite.
Go ahead, Dottie.
One thing that I want to bring into the conversation is the idea that certain beliefs are so deeply rooted that even if you're trained, when you're in a situation, you'll go to default mode. And I think that in this culture, we have a belief of that certain people are more dangerous than other people, that certain people are more criminal than other people. And it's deeply wired and reinforced in a variety of ways. And I could bring up some social psychology research to reinforce that. So with that in mind, it becomes kind of an automatic response when you see certain people. You just kind of automatically presume that they might be more dangerous than others. So what we do have to look at is how do we kind of break that wiring down to decrease the kind of mishaps that we've seen lately, because it is deeply wired.
And I agree. I agree with you. Yeah. And I think we address that. We have to address it through training. And training isn't just how to shoot your gun, use your radio. Training is also how do you deal with people? How do you learn about people? That's what your training is always ongoing, that you have to know who you're policing. You have to get an understanding about how they feel. And I think that's what we have to do in police work, a better job of that. People don't think of you the way you might think of yourself. So we have to do a better job at doing that.
Well, so, Dottie, you almost seem to be saying, correct me if I'm wrong, there's racism in society in general,
right?
Like almost like don't just blame the police. I mean, they're operating in a broader society where certain people are seen as more dangerous than others.
Yeah, we're talking about a larger cultural context here. And I kept saying if we continue to polarize, I don't know if we'll come to the end result that we want to have. And so part of what I'm saying is in order to address what we're seeing now, we have to address the roots of all of this. And this is this whole idea of institutionalized racism, the types of criminal justice systems that reinforce some of the behavior that we're seeing, some of the things that citizens are asking people to do to keep them, quote, safe. And also, I think that I have to indict the educational system as well, because there's so many things that we are not teaching within the educational system to help combat some of the false beliefs or the faulty beliefs that people have. And so we have to do a better job within education. And I think that is at the root of creating a different reality for all of this.
So police are almost the front lines of this much larger problem.
I really do think so.
Let's take some calls, all of you. Chief Mayor, did you want to jump in real quickly there?
I just like to say, though, Willard, just to add to that, when Willard made the point about the underlying causes of everything that's happening, I agree with that. But police, we are out there, and our officers are out there, and they're the ones that have to face the brunt of how the breakdown of what we have, our failings in society.
Right.
So when you're talking about racism, you're talking about poverty, you're talking about mental illness, all those things.
Right.
The police are the face of dealing with that.
Right.
So that is why a lot of these things happen.
Right.
Do you want to jump in, Willard, and then we'll go to our listeners?
Yeah, I do, but we can go to the listeners, and I'm sure I get a chance.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, actually, first, let me just say that earlier, the comments that I made were in response to your question of what were people saying to me. It wasn't necessarily what I thought. Mm-hmm. But as Dr. Dottie was saying, who I respect greatly, racism is real, and it's about power and privilege. But race is not real, and it's a way of both defining, determining, and distributing these power and privilege stuff in society. So as long as we and when we look at, as Daddy was saying, going deep enough, well, we got to go back and we got to look at the beginnings, the origins, and that takes us back to the origins of America, mm-hmm. of the American experiment. You know, even in pre-colonial America. It was set up. We had a society that was set up on oppression. You know, it was basically a police state forcing a group of people to, work against their will. That same kind of structure grew, you know, it was enshrined in the Constitution in 1776. You know, it wasn't really overturned at the end of the Civil War. You know, we got there. Now scientists would tell you about this stuff called epigenetics, where certain kinds of behavior cause certain kinds of gene expressions that carry on. You know, that's why we have grief counselors that come to schools, you know, when a cat gets run over outside the school, or, you know, somebody's, friend gets hurt. We bring in grief counselors to deal with that. America never had that experience, you know. And so there are a lot of even with training, the training happens within a context. And as long as the larger societal context, you know, contains these embedded ideas, then they are reflected, you know, sort of like everything that we do. So I agree with Daddy. I agree with Chief Mara. And one of the things we got to put on the table is this, and one of the things that comes up in conversation, I heard this CNN program where they were talking about the shootings, I think in the second set of shootings in Louisiana, and they were saying that one of the commentators was saying, well, you know, we got to deal with these black people shooting police officers. And one of the commentators said, wait a minute, you know, we have a couple of deranged people who shot police officers. We don't have an example. We don't have a trend of black people, you know, shooting police officers. This is not a result or emerging from the Black Lives Matter movement any more than the assassinations in Pennsylvania of the state troopers, or, you know, in North Carolina or anywhere else where there are police shootings. So as long as we subscribe to these ideas that served at one time to divide society into free and slave, you know, privileged and oppressed, if we don't deal with that, then we're going to end up having similar kinds of situations that we have now where we think we're different. We think we're different based on melanin content, you know, based on appearances, when in fact, we're not.
Lieutenant Cheatham, did you want to jump in? And then got some people who want to join our conversation.
Sure. No, I see the call list is buzzing.
All right, we'll
but
go to them.
I just wanted
them.
To quickly yeah. respond to Dottie, just saying, and I'll speak as a citizen of New Hampshire, not as a police officer, but I'm born and raised here in New Hampshire, educated here in New Hampshire. And I think that while we're talking about national issues, it's also important to discuss local issues as well, and specifically about the Grain Estate. It's been my experience that I think that the people of New Hampshire are some of the most inclusive and open-minded people across our nation. And that's one of the reasons why I've chosen to remain in New Hampshire and to raise a family. And while on a national level we might have some of these underlying racial issues, I just wanted to bring it back home to New Hampshire as well to say I think we do a better job than most in not only talking about these issues. And I just, even speaking to friends of mine of African-American descent, I've never heard them talk about just institutionalized racism that they've experienced ever in their lives living here in New Hampshire. And that's just one thing I wanted to just discuss with Dottie or even bring to the public's attention or hear, what do the viewers have to say?
Well, and I'm really glad you raised that point. And Dottie, you were raised in Louisiana, is that
raised
correct?
Raised in Louisiana,
so,
right.
And here you are.
A much different state, for
yeah,
sure.
Right. Here in Northern New England, and we like to pride ourselves in Northern New England that, we didn't, don't have that, slavery past that they had down south, although we did have slaves here.
Right.
And, we have some of the most famous abolitionists from New Hampshire, so hooray for us. So I just wonder what you think about the differences.
Well, I think that, true, it is qualitatively different. Louisiana, racism is pretty overt. I think that what we fail to look at is when we look at certain kind of discrepancies that exist even in New Hampshire, those discrepancies can be seen along the color line or around the immigration line as well. So if we see discrepancies in education. So it doesn't have to just manifest itself in cross burnings or overt forms of racism. But I'm thinking about some of the more subtle ways that some of the students talk about that they are subjected to or were subjected to as young people within the state. And it's not a slam on New Hampshire. It's just the reality that we're living in a larger cultural context where institutional racism exists, even if personal kinds of racist acts don't occur. That's a longer conversation, and I do hear what you're saying.
Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the email is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Exchange at nhpr.org. We had somebody who called who couldn't stay on, who did want to know about the training. And I know we've all said that, the training can only do so much in this broader context. But I'll turn to you first, I think, Chief Mara. What does police training these days say about, looking out for bias?
Well, I know at the police academy they're going to be starting a new program. but they've also had training on diversity training. And I know in Manchester, when I was there, we did diversity training. I know it's continued. There's also, and I discussed this before, there was also training that trains officers how to deal with youth, minority youth, and to look at it from their point of view. And that training now has been turned. It's an initiative through the DMC, Disproportionate Minority Contact. It's a state committee, and in Manchester, they have a local committee there. In Rochester, they do. In Nashua. And so what they're doing now with that is they are training kids to look to see why cops are doing what they're doing. So you can have this mutual understanding. So you can understand this is why the police do these things. This is why they're stopping you, and this is why they're asking you this. So I know Manchester started teaching it this year in their school, and Nashua, they're doing a great job. I believe they started doing it in their Boys and Girls Club, and I know Rochester is going to be doing their form as well.
So police training is changing as we speak.
It's training, but it's not just about – it's about what we're talking about, understanding communication. So it's more of a community context, not just police.
It sounds more like – more engagement.
Right.
Right.
Than the sitting down and saying, here's your 5-hour online course,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. I just want to let everybody know that we've been having phone troubles, and there were so many people who wanted to jump in our conversation.
You
crashed the lines, exactly. So we're having trouble with that. So if you want to email exchange at nhpr.org. Also, we will get those phone lines up very quickly. In fact, we're going to try now and go to Suzanne in Amherst. And Suzanne, go ahead. You're on the air. Okay, nope, so like I said, yeah, some phone troubles. So, folks, if you want to join our conversation, and we would love to hear from you, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And keep trying to call 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. On the training, Willard, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just mention that I just happened to be run across an article yesterday that was really fascinating. It was from the New York Times. And it's about police training around the country. And they were saying, and the premise of the article was that in most states, cosmetologists are required to have more training than police officers. That cosmetologists in most states have to have, like, you know,
X number of hours.
Well, they get direct training, and then they have to do this internship. And the author is saying that the same is not the case for the for police, by and large, around the country. You know, and there are two different jobs. I guess they were saying that the point was that police have they have the responsibility to make life and death decisions. And so that should suggest that maybe we should have a higher standard of training for them because of that. Not just, you need to be physically fit, you know, or even that you need to be mentally stable. But you also need to, you know, have other training that will allow you to make good decisions.
I think
go ahead, Dottie, and then
maybe Chief
Cheatham.
Maher.
Yeah.
No, I had the honor last year for going through some additional training. It was called Blue Courage.
Yeah,
and I was very moved by what occurred in that training. But it was police officers, individuals who were already police officers, and it was done by the chief of police, I can't remember his name right now. And it was a 2-day training. And the minute he started quoting Maya Angelou as part of the training, I said, I'm hooked. And you could tell that it was more of an engagement between. And so I don't know if you could talk more about that training or if you see that as a good training or not.
I've heard about it, and I could be mistaken, but I believe Tony Colarusso is the Dover chief.
Yes.
And he's also the chairman of the Police Standards and Training Council, who oversees training for police officers and their certifications. And I believe that is coming to the academy.
Oh, good.
Coming up. He was talking about that last night. But as far as training goes, I can only speak for New Hampshire.
Right.
But every police officer has to go to the state academy. Now it's 16 weeks, the academy, to go there. Now, I can talk about Manchester and Portsmouth. Manchester, you go to the – first you have to go to in-house academy, and then you have to go to that police academy, the state police academy, and then afterwards you do field training. It takes you 6 months. And the same thing with the same deal with Portsmouth. So we don't – a police officer doesn't hit the street for 6 months. And if we feel he's not ready or he or she – didn't cut it, then they don't make it.
Okay, and I want to ask you about that too, Lieutenant Cheatham, especially since you're first vice president of the New Hampshire Police Association. After break, we will hear from you as well. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're revisiting our conversation from a month ago about police and minority relations and efforts to get people together after the turmoil we saw in this country in July with African-American men dying at the hands of police and then police in Dallas and Baton Rouge being targeted. 1-800-892-6477 is the number to call. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. And we were talking just a minute ago about training. Is it enough? Not just the training itself, the number of hours, but making sure the right people are in that training. I'd love your thoughts too, Lieutenant Cheatham, whether you want to answer broadly or more specifically in terms of what you had to go through to become a police officer.
Sure. I'll speak more broadly first. I don't think you can ever have enough training, right? Mm-hmm. But you have to reconcile that with budgets and things along those lines. I think here in New Hampshire, again, we do a very good job at preparing our police officers before they go out on the streets to give them the basic tools, knowledge, and experience to then apply that. So the police academy, while being 16 weeks, like Chief Myers said, it was only 12 weeks when I attended some 14 years ago. So over the last 14 years, the Police Standards and Training Council, which is made up of chiefs of police, I believe the colonel of the state police, judges, lawyers, and citizens appointed by the governor through, and I believe confirmed through the executive council. I could be wrong on that, but I know that there are citizen members of Police Standards and Training Council, and continually every month when they meet, when they do their annual reviews, they ask, what can we do better? What else do we need to include in the basic training package for our police officers? And Chief Mayor hit the nail on the head. It's that once officers come out of that police academy, they then need to apply that knowledge through their field training program. I can speak for Londonderry, and most of the police departments across the state, I believe, have a minimum 10 to 12-week field training program where an officer is paired up with a senior officer.
Like an apprenticeship or an internship almost.
In layman's terms, I guess, but it would be like a two-officer car where that junior officer, that freshly trained officer is supervised immediately. So there's no decision that he or she that is making without the direct supervision of a field training officer who he or himself or herself has gone through special training to be able to effectively train another. So it's like a train-the-trainer type program. But even in addition to the police academy, we all must undergo a minimum, and this might not sound like a lot, but a minimum of 8 hours of training outside of the police academy annually, and we have to document that and submit that. That documentation. And that does not include firearms training, defensive tactics training, and many of the other specific topics that we have to be recertified annually upon. So it is more than just being physically fit, but it's being mentally fit as well. And I think that the Police Standards and Training Council, especially through some increased funding and some revamping of how the Police Academy in New Hampshire is funded, is able to bring in some unbelievable speakers across the nation to address the very issues that we're discussing here today.
What about getting the right people into that training? I mean, the training can be as good as gold, but if the people who are applying and to be in this field don't have the right attitude, does the training weed those folks out?
I know Chief Barr offer some great input on this, but I mean, one thing you don't know maybe, Laura, is I've also been a polygraph examiner for the last 9 years. And as such, I've been involved in the hiring process for almost every Londonderry police officer for the last 9 years and also many of the area agencies. Because here in New Hampshire, I'd say 99% of the police departments require a polygraph as a condition of employment for any police officer. And it is difficult to hire a highly qualified candidate because we have a very extensive vetting process through not only written examinations, but we call them oral board interviews. Then you have the police academy, which is itself a vetting process. You then have the field training program, which is another vetting process. And ultimately, when the officer goes on the road by him or herself, that's really the final vetting process, isn't it? Because that's when you really know whether that officer is listening to his or her training and has developed those skills to understand the duties that we have out on the road. But I'll speak today. The caliber of candidate that we're getting applying to these positions, we find so many people just applying just to say, I need a job. And it wasn't like that 10 years ago. And I'm speaking generally. We still are able to find, those 2, 3, 4, 5 excellent candidates out of a pool of 100. And tell me a profession where you have people show up in the hundreds to apply for, and then you have to then whittle down, basically, not to minimize, but to select those few select officers that you know are going to have the trust and confidence, not only of the police department, but of the community, to go out there and serve and protect.
Chief Mara, has a lot of this negative publicity about police and the bystander videos and you see behavior that's, unsavory. Has that hurt recruitment efforts here in New Hampshire?
I can't quantify this, but I believe it has. I think we're already competing for, as the lieutenant said, we're already competing for a few people. And so when you get this day after day, all this negative press about police, it definitely has an effect.
Will it let people say that some of these issues might be lessened if there were more people from different backgrounds on the police forces in New Hampshire. What efforts have you seen to make Manchester's police force or Portsmouth's police force or Keene or Concord more diverse? And would that really help?
Well, I'll start out by answering your last question, is that I don't know that that would necessarily help. Even when we look at the police shootings in Dallas and Louisiana, we see that the people that were shot, they were shot because they were police, not because of any particular, ancestry or ethnicity.
And one of the officers killed in Baton Rouge was African-American.
Right, right. And you know, as we look around the country and over time, we see that, police officers of all, backgrounds have been killed in the line of duty, and it's because they're police. One of the issues that the second question, the first question actually was about training. Manchester has put on has been fairly active in attempting to diversify the police force in terms of strategies, attending career fairs, actually hosting information sessions about the openings, having an information session where people can come in and hear descriptions and ask questions about what does it mean to be a police officer. Manchester Police Force is going to be represented at the We Are One Festival on August 13th in Manchester. They're going to have a table there, and they've been there the last few years recruiting, reaching out, in this community setting. So there has been some efforts. There has been some efforts to pull in uniformed police officers. One of the things that I've suggested to talk with the Manchester police and have, had positive responses and from previous police chief and the current one, and that is, I think, in terms of really developing a relationship between different communities and the police department, that there needs to be a focused effort at bringing in non-uniformed personnel so that when people come to the police department and deal with police employees, they feel like, oh yeah, I know somebody that works there. Right now, because of the reputation, Chief Mara said that some of what's going on now in the news is causing people to be reluctant to be policemen and impacting recruiting. In many communities, for a long time, police have had a negative reputation and have been viewed negatively, and that's made it really difficult to convince people to, reluctant. It made people reluctant to want to be police because they view them as...
Why would I want to join that group?
Yeah. Well, no, why would I want to join that gang? They're the bad guys.
So the phone lines are still down. The only way for you to join us with your comments and questions is by email, and it's exchange@nhpr.org. And I do apologize to our listeners for that. But here's a couple emails I'd love to share with all of you. And here's one from Mary. Are there statistics showing whether minorities are disproportionately arrested in New Hampshire as they are in many other places? And Dottie, I think you've done some looking at that.
I wasn't able to contact Andrew Smith in time to get that information, but I'm sure the chief has some of that information.
Yeah, well, again, the question, are minorities disproportionately arrested in New Hampshire? Yeah.
Well, Andrew, for the most part, deals with juveniles. It's right. A juvenile justice project, but I have an opinion about nationwide, and it goes back to how society has failed. There is a disproportionate amount of minorities that are incarcerated if you look at our population as a whole, right. And I think it has to do with the root causes. This society has failed. Why is it happening? That's what we have to do as a nation.
We keep getting back to that. We have to.
You have to. Something is wrong, and anybody that doesn't say there's something wrong with that, the facts are there that there is the disproportionate amount of minorities are incarcerated, and we are failing somehow.
And I don't know about New Hampshire. And again, it goes back to my original. A point I made earlier about perceptions that people have of who's more dangerous. And I think that even when you look at small children, there's tons of research on this. And if a black boy, 3-4 years old, engage in a behavior that's consistent with what you would see in a child, it would be perceived in a different way than if a white boy of the same age engaged of it. There was a study that was done in 2013 that looked at how people don't perceive black and Latino children as children. They see them as older and less innocent as they do. So let's just think about this for a moment. If a child engages in a behavior in school that's similar, the way that it will be interpreted will be qualitatively different based on the race of the child. This is not something I'm making up. This is something that has been documented in a well-documented study that was done in 2013. So what does that mean? That means that the child, the African-American child or the Latino child, will be given a more severe consequence than the white child who is engaging in the same behavior. So if we fast forward that to our criminal justice system, once again, documented cases, I don't know about New Hampshire, documented cases where a sentence is a lot more severe for some of the same behaviors. So therefore, it would overpopulate the criminal justice system in a way that we don't quite see on the surface. I don't want to just indict the criminal justice system. There was a study done with psychologists. Psychologists, were, as a psychologist, were more inclined to give a more severe diagnosis to especially Latino men and black men than they were of any other groups of people presenting the same symptoms. So what does that say? It continues to say that we have some perceptions that are deeply rooted in race and oftentimes class.
Mary, thank you for the email. And here's an email from Sharon who says, is it imperative that we look at the larger context of racism in America, where it is being played out in the national arena with bad behavior, as if it is the last gasp of institutional racism and white privilege in America? The demographics tell the story. Sharon, thank you for the email. Here's one from Teresa in Conway who says, I'm sitting in the parking lot of the high school where my black child has repeatedly been called the N-word. He is not a fighter, but has been egged on to engage in fighting. Teresa says, I don't believe that New Hampshire is immune to overt racism. And Teresa, I'm sorry to hear about that. And thank you very much for joining us by email. Here's an email from Ivan, who tried to call a couple times, Ivan, and I apologize about the phones. Ivan says, I have worked as a parole officer and had the same training as police officers. The key is training. We are all human beings. We all have bias. Training can help mitigate that because in crisis, we all fall back to our training. At the academy, we need more accountability and less solidarity. Thank you, Ivan, for that. And sort of related to that point, here's an email from James who says, I'd like to see more good police arresting bad police. James says, why don't we see that very often? Chief Mayor, can you talk about that? I read something about that just recently, that with the huge amount of video available, now an officer standing by sees his fellow officer doing something that maybe he or she shouldn't be doing. Everybody says to that officer, why didn't you do something? I mean, talk about the so-called good police interacting with the so-called bad police, to use the words of our emailer.
Okay. Well, any officer in any police department, I would venture to guess, there's an SOP that you have a requirement as a police officer.
Standard operating procedure.
Standard operating procedure to report any bad behavior by a police officer. And when you see a criminal act, if somebody is acting not properly at an arrest scene or if they see a crime being committed, you do have a duty to report that as a police officer. But let me put it in the context when you say good, bad police officers. There are 900,000 police officers. And if you think about how many arrests those police officers make and nothing happens from that. Everything is proper. The vast majority of arrests, interactions with the community, police officers act right. Now, there are some people out there that with 900,000, you're going to have some people that aren't very good police officers. You might even have some bad people, and they do some bad things. But if you keep it in the context of how many police officers we have that go out there every day, and if you look at Manchester, I think they were averaging like 6,000 arrests a year. And if you look at citizens' complaints, out of 6,000 arrests, and that's not counting tickets, that's not counting, that's going to 100,000 calls for service. I think we always averaged under 40, 45 citizens' complaints a year. And the same thing in Portsmouth. There's not many citizens' complaints. And the reason being is training. You have to train your officers, and I keep on coming back to that. But as far as good and bad police officers, there are very few, in my experience in 29 years, there are very few bad police officers.
Well, and James, I hope that answers your question. Thank you. And Mary, who emailed earlier about statistics about whether minorities are disproportionately arrested in New Hampshire. Mary, just want to let you know that NHPR is looking into some of the statistics surrounding minority treatment in the criminal justice system. So we're digging into that. Don't have anything quite just yet, but that'll be coming out soon. You know, all of you, we have to wrap it up here. And one thing we didn't touch on is the video, the cell phones that everybody pulls out. Dash cams, body cameras, the impact. So maybe that's maybe that's for another time. Lieutenant Cheatham, you want to jump in? I can give you like 15 seconds, but that's about it.
I was just going to expand upon what Chief Myers said. You know, less than 1% of 1% of the 900,000 police officers across our nation, you know, are involved in a deadly force situation, which is a very low number when you think about it, again, across the entire nation. And while we're seeing what is perceived to be this increase of law enforcement use of deadly force, I don't think that the numbers actually support that. But again, we need to continue to study, continue to talk, and continue to communicate. And nice to see everyone again.
Okay. All of you, it is good to have you all here. Dottie, super quick.
Nope.
Okay. Everybody, thank you very much for coming in. Dottie, good to see you. Thank you for coming over from Keene.
Thank you very much.
And Lieutenant Cheatham, thanks again for your time. I know you're a busy guy. And Chief Mara, same to you. Thank you very much for taking time out. Willard, good to see you. Thank you.
Yes.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Google Play for NHPR Exchange.